Hello, this is Thelma English, and I'm going to be reading to you from Book 10 of Virgil's Aeneid. We're reading from the Robert Fitzgerald translation of Virgil's Aeneid, beginning Book 10. The Olympian Hall of Jove, Zeus, admitted morning, and there the father of gods and king of men convoked a council in that starry court from which he viewed the bright lands far below, the Dardan fortress camp. The Trojans, the Latin races, when all the gods had taken seats together in the great court with gates to east and west, he said to them, so Zeus gives a speech, "Lords of the open sky, why this reversion to old thoughts and aims and bitter strife again? I had forbidden Italy to engage in war with the Trojans. Under that ban, what does this conflict mean? What fear made those on this side and that resort to arms, incite to arms? The time for war will come. You need not press for it. That day when through the Alps laid wide open, the savagery of Carthage blights the towns and towers of Rome. Then men may strive in hate, then havoc one another. Now refrain." So what Zeus is referring to is the Punic Wars that, of course, are in the past for Virgil, but he's writing as though those are in the future. The Punic Wars were from 264 to 146 BC, and it started, they were fighting over Sicily, the Romans and the Carthaginians. Then Hannibal came over, famously, came over the Alps, actually from Spain, on elephants, and then Rome destroyed Carthage in 146, the same year that they destroyed Corinth, and that was the end of that. The men strive in hate, then havoc one another. Now refrain. Line 21. Be pleased to endorse the league I have decreed. Jupiter's words were few. Not so the words of golden Venus in reply. So now Venus Aphrodite has a speech, and her words are not few. They're lengthy. O Father, eternal Lord of men and their affairs, what other power may one call on now? Don't you see how Rutulians gloat? How Turnus rides in his car, his chariot among them, all puffed up with his good luck in war? Closed walls no longer shield the Trojans. No, inside the gates they must do battle on the very ramparts, and moats run high with blood. All unaware, Aeneas is far away. Now will you never let that siege be raised? So Venus is complaining her people are at a disadvantage. Their leader is gone, and their walls are broken down. Once more an enemy looms at the walls of budding Troy. Once more a host of soldiers, and once more the son of Tydeus, like a Diomedes, like a brand new Diomedes. Once more the son of Tydeus, this time from the Aetolian Arpi, rises against the Trojans. Yes, I think my wounds are yet in store for me, and I, your child, but keep the mortal spearman waiting. So if you remember back in the Iliad Book 5, Diomedes wounded Aphrodite, Venus, and she went crying back to her mother to get healed. So she says she can almost feel the spearman. She's going to get stabbed again, she thinks. Line 41. If without your consent, your heavenly will, the Trojans crossed to Italy, then let them pay for their sins, afford them no relief. But if they had those many oracles, heavens and the underworlds behind them, why can the first who comes ignore your will and form new destinies? Must I recall the burning ships on Eryx's shore? If you remember back in Book 5 in Sicily, they burned their ships. Do I have to recall the burning ships on Eryx's shore? The king of Tempest and the gales unleashed out of Aeolia, is Iris born from Cloudland? Even the powers of hell are stirred by Juno now. That third part of the world remained untried, the one third of the world that Hades is in charge of. Alecto, that fury, has been ushered suddenly into the upper world and goes in frenzy through Italian towns. No thought of empire moves me now, only one hoped for, that while fortune's held, let those you favor conquer. If there is no place on earth, your pitiless consort, in other words, Juno, Hera, will allow the Trojans, then by the smoking rubble of fallen Troy, I beg you, Father, let me send Ascanius unharmed out of the war. Let him live on, my grandson. Granted, Aeneas may be tossed on strange waters again and lay his course when fortune shows the way, but let my strength only protect this child and save him now from deadly combat. Amanthus is mine, and Paphosite, Cytheria, and Adalia. So she says these are cities of Cyprus. These are her cities. There let him put his arms away and spend his life ingloriously. Ordain that Carthage crush beneath her sway Ausonian's power, southern Italy's power. No hindrance there to the city-states of Tyre. What use then to escape that plague of war, to take flight through the midst of Argive fire? desires, to taste all bitter perils of the sea and the vast earth, looking for Latium, looking for Italy, for Pergama, Troy, reborn. And would it not have served them better to have made a home upon the ashes of their land, the soil where Troy once was? Just give them Xanthus back, and Samos, I beg. Let the poor Trojans live through Ilium's hard hours again. Then queenly Juno, stung to fury, said, why force me to break silence long and deep, and put abroad in words my hidden pain of men and gods? Did any drive Aeneas to choose war, to march as an enemy against the Latin king? He sailed for Italy under the fates' direction. Let it be so. And spurred on by the mad fits of Cassandra, did he leave camp, trust life to the wild winds under my influence, or give a boy authority in war, command of ramparts, or trouble Etruscan loyalty, or the lives of peaceful folk? What god, what cruelty of mine impelled him to this harm? Where now is Juno to be found in this, or Iris down from the clouds? Intolerable that Italians ring your budding Troy with flames, that Turnus set foot on the soil of his fatherland, whose grandfather was Pelumnus, and whose mother divine Vanilla. That's a sea nymph. What then of the torch the Trojans carry smoking against Latins? What of their subjugating others' fields and driving off their herds? What shall we say of how they take their pick of fathers-in-law, and drag the betrothed girl from her lover's arms? How with their hands outstretched they pray for peace and armor their beaked ships? Oh, you, of course, can steal Aeneas from the hands of Greeks, and spread in the man's place ground, mist, and air, and change a fleet into so many nymphs. So she's talking about you can grab your son from the hands of the Greeks, because she also grabbed her son Paris Alexander, her favorite, not her son, Paris Alexander, from the Greeks when Menelaus was about to get him, and changed a fleet into so many nymphs, that I, for my part, helped the Rutulians, Turnus's people, somewhat. Is this abominable? All unaware. Aeneas is far away. All unaware, and far away let him remain. Your homes are Paphos, Idalium, and Cythera's height. Why go afield to a walled town, rife with war and rugged fighting hearts? Am I the one who has attempted to bring Phrygia's, Troy's, frail kingdom down? Am I? Or is it not the man who pitied the poor Trojans once against Achaeans? What is the cause that made them, Europe and Asia, break the peace and rise in arms? Through treachery, guided by me, did the adulterous Dardan, that would be Paris Alexander, make his conquest over Sparta, because Helen was a Spartan queen? Or did I supply the weapons, or foment the war with lust? You should have feared then for your people. Now, late in the day, you rise to make your moan, unfounded too, and bait me pointlessly. So ran the plea of Juno, and the lords of sky, each to his mind, murmured assent. And as what was it like when they all murmured assent? As when the early gusts, caught in a forest, murmur, and the rustling unseen wind rolls on, the harbinger of gales to come for men at sea. The Almighty Father, then, chief power of the world, began to speak, and as he spoke, the great hall of the gods fell silent, and earth quaked, and silence reigned in highest air. The west winds went to rest. The deep sea stilled his waters into calm, and now Zeus speaks. Take heed, then, and keep fast in memory these words of mine, whereas Ausonians are not allowed to league themselves with Trojans, and it is not acceptable to you to end your discord. Therefore, I shall hold without distinction Rutulians and Trojans, whatever fortune each may have today. So Zeus says, for just today, I don't care. Do whatever you want. Whatever hope may guide him, that's line 150, whether the camp lies under siege, as fated for Italians, or through Troy's blunder, and through prophecies malign and dark, neither do I exempt the Rutulians. The effort each man makes will bring him luck or trouble. To them all, King Jupiter is the same king, and the fates will find their way. Then, by his Stygian brothers' rivers, boiling banks and black whirlpool, he took oath nodding. So Zeus just took an oath by the river Styx. Remember, it's the oath you can't break. Making all Olympus tremble at his nod, there was an end of speaking. A Jupiter from his golden throne, Zeus, arose, and lords of heaven on either hand escorted him to the threshold of its hall. That day the Rutulians beset all gates, line 165, fighting to kill, to ring the walls with flame. The Aenean legion could but bear the siege, immured within, and had no hope of flight. Poor soldiers, helpless to break out, they stood on towers aloft and thinly manned the ramparts. There, and now there's a list of a whole bunch of men, there was Asius, Imbrosius' son, Thermodes, Hicinian's son, and I'm slaughtering the names, and both Asarchae with Castor and the old Thrymbus in the front line, Sarpedon's brothers, then, Clarus and Thamon from Highland of Lycia, there Acmon of Licinius, great in bulk as Clytius his father or his brother Mnestheus, with all his might lifted a stone, so huge it seemed the fragment of a mountain. Some with javelins fought the besiegers off, some with stones, or throwing firebrands and fitting arrows to the bowstring. Sea enclosed by them, the Dardan prince himself, there's Aeneas, so Aeneas is fighting where he's at, remember. The Dardan prince himself, most fitting ward of Venus, his fair head uncovered, as a jewel shines out innet in yellow gold, a jewel for throat or brow as a pale ivory glows, inlaid by craft in boxwood or Arician terebinth, upon his milky nape the flowing hair, caught in a pliant golden band, came down, and Ismarus, you too were seen by young high-hearted kinsmen as you aimed your shots and armed your shafts with poison, well-born son of a Mnaean house where ploughmen turn rich earth, Pactolus waters with its gold, and Mnestheus too was there, exalted still by yesterday's great feat, when he fought Turnus down from the rampart, Capys too, whose name descends to us in the companion city. That day all these fought on in bitter war, but in the middle of that night Aeneas ploughed the coastal sea. So as soon as he's done fighting, he gets on his ship to go back. When he had left Evander and reached the camp of the Etruscans, he sought the king, told him his name and race, what help he looked for and what help he brought, informed him of the levies that Mezentius won over and of the violent heart of Turnus, reminded him of how unsure the plans of men are, and so reasoning, made his plea. Line 210. No time was lost. Tarchon joined forces with him, sealed a pact, and, freed from fate's delay, the Lydian host pledged to a foreign captain, at the command of heaven went to sea. So Aeneas also talked the Etruscans into helping him fight. Line 215. Aeneas's ship sailed first in line. Her beak showed Phrygian lions below a figurehead of Ida, welcome sight to exiled Trojans. So the figurehead is the thing on the prow of a boat that's carved into a figure, and his is Phrygian lions, Trojan lions. There great Aeneas sat and inwardly reflected on the fortunes of the war. And Pallas, his best friend now, at his left hand questioned him, now of the stars, the course laid through the night, now of adventures met by land and sea. Muses, throw wide the gates of Helicon, and lift your song of all that host that sailed beneath Aeneas's flag from Tuscan shores, and manned the ships and rode the sea. Masicus, first in the bronze-beaked tiger, cleft the waves, commander of 1,000 men who left the walls of Clusium and Cosa City, arrows their weapons, quivers lightly slung and deadly bows. Along with him sailed Abas, grizzled and grim, his whole ship's company in richest armor, and his ship agleam with gilt Apollo for a figurehead. His Papillonian motherland had sent 600 practiced fighters, and 300 came from the Isle of Elba, rich in ore, in inexhaustible mines of the Chalbes. Third came the interpreter of gods to men, Asilas, who commanded all presage, so he's a seer, of entrails on the altar, stars in heaven. Flight of birds, prophetic lightning fires. So this guy is the interpreter birds and stuff, Asilas. He hurried aboard ship 1,000 men in close formation, rugged ranks of spears placed under him by the Tuscan town of Pisa, settled from Greece, from Alpheus riverside. Astur came next, the handsomest of captains, confident horsemen bearing motley arms. 300 soldiers more had been dispatched, like-minded in their zeal by those at home in care, and the plains of Minio in ancient Phrygi, fever prone Graviscae. Line 255. Cunaris, never could I pass you by, bravest in war of the Ligurian captains, nor you with your scant following Capavo, plumage of swan upon your crest, a sign reproaching Amor and his goddess mother with your own father's change of form. Cincus, they say, when mounting Phaethon in Phaethion's young sister's poplar shade among the new leaves, quieting with song his woe for love lost, dressed himself in softest plumage as in snowy age, and left the earth enchanting, sought the stars. With crewmen young as he, the son, Capavo, drove ahead with oars the giant centaur figurehead. So his ship has a centaur on it. That towered, threatening the waves with a great boulder, the tall ship with long keel driven, furrowed the open sea. Then Ocnus came, who roused his company from the paternal waterways, a son of Sibylline Mantua in the Tuscan River. Mantua, it was he who gave you walls and named you for his mother, Mantua, rich in forebears, not of a single stock, but three distinct tribes, each with four communes, the chief one, Mantua, whose vigor came from Tuscan blood. Mezentius's cruelness had there aroused 500 sturdy men to take up arms against him. These were led by a pine-timbering ship whose prow showed Minicus River flowing out of Garda. Father Garda in gray veil of sedge. Then, heavy in the waves, Aulestes came surging ahead, as 100 tree-trunk oars lashed at the sea and turned it up in foam. Huge Triton bore him, and the blue sea quailed before the figure's conch, the dipping torso down to the flanks, a shaggy man, his belly merged with a monster of the sea, that's his what's on his prow. Beneath the semi-human breast, the foaming groundswell murmured. All these many captains in 30 ships had sailed for Troy's relief and sheared the expanse of brine with brazen prows. Meanwhile, the next day, daylight left the sky, and the mild moon, its night now, in mid-heaven rode her night-wandering car. But duty would not give Aeneas rest. He held the tiller still shifted sail. Then look, halfway upon his course, a band of old companions hove in sight. The nymphs, whom kind Cybele had by her command, transformed from ships to nymphs and given power over the sea. These are the ships that were turned to nymphs. These nymphs are coming to talk to him or give him help. Swimming abreast they came, parting the waves, as many at one time had prows of bronze and moored ashore. Far off they knew their king, and like a dancing chorus, veered around his ship. One most adept at speaking, Cymodocea, in his wake, took hold of the ship aft with her right hand, and pulled herself up, as her left hand kept her stroke in quiet water. Then she spoke to the still unwitting captain. Still awake, Aeneas, kin to gods. Be wakeful then, and slacken off your sheet. We are those pines from Ida's holy crest, and once your fleet, now become sea nymphs. When the base Rutulian bore down on us with sword and fire, headlong we broke our cables, though against our will. All through the sea we looked for you. This form the mother of gods in pity fashioned for us, allowing us, as goddesses, to spend our lives under the waves. Now learn from us, the boy Ascanius, say, so your son, is pinned down behind his wall and moat, amid attacking spears of Latins, rough in onslaught. Even now Arcadian horse mingled with brave Etruscans hold their appointed place, but Turnus plans to throw his squadrons in between to keep the Arcadians from your camp. Now up with you. As dawn comes, order a call to arms for all your troops and take the shield of the Lord of Fire. Okay, the shield that Hephi made him, or Vulcan, or Mulciber. Himself supplied you, made unconquerable and rimmed with gold. If you'll trust what I say, the new day sees heaps of Rutulians slain. When she had said this, as she slipped away, with her right hand she sped the tall ship onward, so she gives it a little push. He having the skill of it, the ship more swift than javelin or arrow, down the wind took flight over the waves. The ships behind lifted the pace. Anchises, Trojan's son, Aeneas, amazed and baffled, even so took heart and comfort from the omen. Raising his eyes to heaven's vault, briefly he prayed, "A benignant lady of Ida, mother of gods," I think that's Gaia or Cybele, "to whom Mount Didymus is dear, and towered cities and lions yoked in tandem under harness, be my first patroness in combat. Bring fulfillment of the augury. Come near the Phrygian soldiers, goddess, and advance with friendly stride." He prayed thus as the day came swiftly round again with ripened light and routed darkness. First, he gave his people orders to act on signals, to devote their minds to war and fit themselves for action. But now, as he stood high upon the stern, he had the Trojans and a camp in view. On his left arm, holding the shield ablaze, he raised it up now. From the walls the Trojans shouted to heaven, line 365. Hope reawakened wrath, and they hurled missiles, clamoring as when the... Okay, what was it like when they saw that Aeneas is almost there? It was clamoring. It was as when the cranes that home on Strymon through the clouds call back and forth as they traverse the heavens, leaving the south behind with cheerful cries. Rutulian prince and captains of Ausonia marveled first at all this, till they turned and saw the sterns already nearing shore, the whole sea moving landward with ships. Aeneas's helmet blazed. This is Aeneas's Aristia. This is very much like Achilles' Aristia when Athena stood behind him and shouted when he shouted, and he had a golden aura around his head. Aeneas's helmet blazed. Flames from the crest gushed upward. The gold boss of his great shield shot out vast firelight, even as when blood-red, ill-omened, through transparent night, a comet glows or Sirius comes up. that burning star that brings drought and disease to ill mankind and makes all heaven drear with baleful shining. Not for that did old Turnus fail in audacity, in his confident hope to occupy the shore first and drive back the invaders from the beach. Here is the chance you've prayed for, now to hack them up with swords. The battle is in your hands, men. Let each soldier think of his wife, his home. Let each recall heroic actions. So this is Turnus getting his men ready to fight Aeneas, who's landing on shore. Great feats of our fathers, line 391. Down to the surf we go, while they're in trouble, disembarking, losing their footing. Fortune favors men who dare. Now he took thought for what troops he should lead in the assault, and those to leave, pressing the siege. Meanwhile, Aeneas put men off on landing ramps from the high sterns. They waited, many of them, for the slack water and the breakers' ebb, and leapt into the shallows. Some held on to oars for steadiness. Now Tarchon sighted shoreline, without a sandbar or long breakers, only the sea swelling, going in, unhindered to a line of surf and smother. He swung his prows at once and begged his men, "Picked oarsmen, now give way with your good oars, and lift the bow with every stroke. Then split this enemy. Land wide open with your beaks. Let each keel plow the shingle. It's all one with me if we break up, beaching her here until the dry land is under us. So go fast as you can, even if you beach your ship." At this, the crew, this is Aeneas' crew, surged at the oars and drove the ships in spume against the mainland till the prows crunched in and keels in safety came to rest. "But not yours, Tarchon. Grounded in shoal water, she hung tipped over on a sloping reef, a long time balancing, tiring the swell until she came apart and spilled her crew into the waves. Oar hafts and floating thwarts impeded seamen. Undertow pulled back their feet from under them. At the same time, line 425, no sluggishness held Turnus. On the double he brought his line of battle down upon the Trojans and disposed it on the shore. Now trumpets gave their signal. In the lead, Aeneas broke through troops from the countryside, a first good omen for the fight to come, and mowed the Latins down. He killed the giant Theron, who left rakes to encounter him, bent on meeting the enemy champions, a sword blade driven through his bronze chainmail and tunic stiff with gold drank from his side, slashed open. Next, Aeneas slung Lycus down, a man excised from his dead mother's womb and held then consecrate to you, Apollo, so a guy born Caesarian, as one who had been granted immunity in infancy from the perilous knife. Nearby, Aeneas hurled to death tough Cisseus and Gaius the gigantic. These with clubs had bludgeoned ranks of men, but Heracles' old weapon in their powerful hands could not help them win through, nor could their sire Melampus, comrade of Hercules, in those days when earth afforded him hard labors, Hercules' 12 labors. Then as Ferus babbledoze, Aeneas sent his javelin spinning, look, into his yelling mouth. You too, unlucky Sidon, at the side of Clytius, your latest joy, whose cheeks were goldening with down, so he was just doesn't even have a beard yet, might have succumbed to the Dardan's blow and lain pitiful sight, free of the loves you ever bore young men, had not your band of brothers in a mass come forward, Phorcus's son, all seven of them, hurling seven javelins. A number glanced ineffectual from helm and shield, and others kindly Venus turned aside, so they should only graze him. Aeneas spoke to loyal Achates, "Hand me still more spears. Of those lodged in the Greeks at Ilium, my throwing arm will not send one astray." He took a heavy spear and cast it hard, line 466, winged in the air so that it crashed clean through the brazen shield of Maeon, then stove in his breastplate and his breast. Alcanor, who had run to help, held up his falling brother, but passing onward into its bloody way, the spear went through his arm, and the arm hung lifeless on its tendons from his shoulder. Numenator then, pulling the spear away out of his brother Maeon's body, threw it back at Aeneas, but had not the luck to hit him, only grazed Achates' thigh. Now up came one from Cures, Clausus, bold in the first flush of youth, putting his back into a long shot with his rigid spear. He hit Dropas just beneath the chin. The point passed through his throat and took his life and voice upon the instant as he gave a cry. His forehead smote the ground and he spewed gore. By various strokes, Clausus brought down as well three Thracians, line 485, men of Boreas's high house, and thee whom Father Idas from their country Ismarus had sent, then Chemhalasus, then the Aronian troops, Messapus then the cavalry leader, Neptune's son, first these, then that those fought hard to push the landing parties back, and on Ausonian's very threshold the pitched battle raged. As in wide heaven, what was it like? As in wide heaven contrary winds do battle, matched in force and impetus, and neither will give way to the other, nor will clouds nor sea give way. The fight hangs in the balance, power to power, locked in stalemate. Even so, the ranks of Troy and the ranks of the Latins met in combat, foot to foot, unbudging, man to man. At another point, line 500, a stream in flood had rolled a scattering of stones and trees uprooted. Here, where the rough watercourse had made them leave their mounts and fight on foot against their custom, Pallas saw Arcadians turn their backs on Latins in pursuit. In that crisis, he had but one recourse, to sting them by appeals and bitter chiding. Friends, so this is Pallas, Aeneas's best friend. Friends, where are you bound? I beg you now, by all the brave things you have done. The wars fought through your leader, great Evander, with my own hopes of emulating him. Put no faith in retreat. The way ahead has to be cleared by cold steel through the enemy. There, where the mass of them is heaviest, your proud land calls you forward, and calls me, Pallas, your captain. No unearthly powers stand in our way. We are hemmed in by soldiers, mortal as we are mortal. Just as many lives, as many hands belong to us. Look how the deep sea's barrier behind us cuts us off. No land there for retreat. Is the camp we head for, or the water? With this he charged the clump of enemy center. First to meet him, led by cruel fate, was Lagus, as this man tore from the ground a heavy boulder. Pallas put a javelin through him where the spine divides the ribs, then pulled it from the cage of bone it clung to. There, as he bent over, his bow failed to hit him. Though he hoped to, running up in reckless rage at a comrade's cruel death, Pallas received him with a sword thrust deep in his expanded lung. Next he went after Stentheus and the scion of Rhoeteus's line, Anechimus, who dared his stepmother's incestuous bed. And you, twin brothers, too, Larides Thymber, fell on the Rutulian field. Identical sons of Daucus, so alike, their parents happily bemused, could never tell the two apart. Now Pallas made a grim distinction. Now Evander's blade cut Thymber's head off, while for you, Larides, dying fingers of your right hand, severed, fluttered as they groped for the sword hilt. Made hot by his reproach, line 5-4-5, and seeing him flight with such distinction, the Arcadians were armed with rage and shame against the foe. Then Pallas put a spear through Rhoeteus as he sped past him in his car. His chariot, escaping you, noble Teuthras, and your brother Tyrs, that gave a breathing space to Ilus, target of Pallas's spear, which Rhoeteus intercepted. Down from his car he rolled and kicked the earth of Italy as he died. When the winds rise, longing for in summer, a shepherd kindles fires. So what was it like? A shepherd kindles fires in woods at scattered points. Then in a rush, the spaces in between blaze up, and Vulcan's line of battle spreads without a break in ragged flame across the countryside. And seeing that he has brought it off, the man looks down on the triumphant fires. Just so. Brave acts of comrades came together. Pallas on one tableau of bravery for your sake. But now against them came Halaseus, keen in warfare, braced in armor. First he killed Ladon, then Pheres, then Demodocus. With a sword flash he lopped off the right hand Stramenius had raised, aimed at his throat. Then with a stone he smashed the face of Thoas, shattering the skull bones, mixed with brains and blood. His father had foretold Halaseus's fate, and hidden him in woodland, but the day the old man closed his glazing eyes in death in the parque, the fates took the son in hand to be cut down, blood sacrificed by Evander's spear. Thus it was that Pallas prayed before he threw against him, grant, O father Tiber, luck to the steel of this shaft I let by, a passage through the hard chest of Halaseus. Then those arms that I shall strip from him shall be your oaks to hold. This the god heard, line 585, for while Halaseus held his shield for him on, he left his chest bare to the Arcadian spear. Now Lausus, a great figure in the battle, would let no troops of his be terrified by all the carnage heroic Pallas wrought. His first exploit was bringing Abas down, Abas who faced him, naughty bastion of Trojans in the fight. Arcadians fell, Etruscans fell, and you too, Trojan soldiers, bodies the Greeks had left unscathed. The lines of troops met, matched in strength and officers, crowded by rear ranks till the congested front allowed no elbow room for weaponry. Here Pallas strove and pressed. Against him Lausus, no such disparate in age, and both splendid in height and build, but fortune gave neither a homecoming to his native land. Now, though, the mighty ruler of Olympus would not let them encounter one another. Their fates awaited them, each at the hands of a still greater foe. The nymph Juturna, Turnus's loving and immortal sister, counseled him to go to Lausus's aid. From his command post, the battle's heart, In a flying chariot he cut his way, and seeing his own men cried, "The time has come to interrupt this battle. I take Pallas, Pallas falls to me. I wish his father stood here to watch." At his command, the troops drew off, clearing the ground. As they gave way, the Arcadian, struck by the arrogant command, stood amazed at Turnus. Casting his eyes upon the giant form, he took his measure, all at a distance still, with a grim stare, then countered thus the tyrant's brutal words. So now Pallas replies, "Either I win the honor of taking spoils from the enemy commander, or I die a noble death. My father will bear alike one destiny or the other. No more threats." He strode into the open, and the blood turned cold in the hearts of the Acadians. Down from his chariot, Turnus leapt and lunged on foot to close quarters. As a lion, what was it like? As a lion after he sights from some high place, a bull far off, spoiling for combat on the plain, goes bounding forward. Such was the look of Turnus as he came on. Okay, so toward Pallas. When he seemed near enough for a spear cast, Pallas opened the engagement. Hoping his daring would bring luck to him, outmatched in power as he was, he cried to the open air above him. So he's appealing to Hercules now, a praying. "By my father's welcome to the feast by which you came a stranger, Heracles, now lend your help to my great effort here, I pray. Let Turnus, dying, see me take his blood-stained arms and bear the side of me, his conqueror." Hercules heard him. Deep in his heart he quelled a mighty groan and let the vain tears flow. At this the Olympian father addressed his son in kindness. So this is Jupiter talking to Heracles about man's fate. Because remember, Heracles got to go to heaven and be a god. "Every man's last day is fixed. Lifetimes are brief and not to be regained for all mankind, but by their deeds to make their fame last. That is labor for the brave. Below the walls of Troy so many sons of gods went down. Among them, yes, my child Sarpedon. Turnus, too, is called by fate. He stands at the given limit of his years." So saying, Jupiter turned his eyes away from the land of the Rutulians. On the field, with all his might, Pallas let fly his spear, then drew his flashing blade out of the sheath. Onward the shaft flew till it punched its way through layers of the shield rim, then struck home there where the cuirass lapped the ridge of shoulder, grazing Turnus's great torso in the end. But after balancing for a long time his oaken shaft with whetted head of steel pointed at Pallas, Turnus hurled it, saying, "Watch this, and see if my spearhead has not more penetrating power." With quivering shock, his point ripped through the center of the shield, through all the skins of steel and bronze and bull's hide, outer integuments, and then punched through the cuirass armor and the stalwart chest. Pallas pulled from the wound the warm spearhead in vain, for blood and life came out as well by the same passage. Forward on his torn breast he plunged, his armor clanging over him, and bit the hostile earth with bloody mouth as he gave up his life. So Turnus just killed Pallas, and all Pallas was able to do was just graze Turnus. Looming above him, Turnus called, "Arcadians, note well and take back to Evander what I say. In that state which his father merited, I send back Pallas, and I grant in full what honor tombs confer, what consolation comes of burial. No small price he'll pay for welcoming Aeneas." So Turnus says, "Go ahead, Arcadians, go ahead and take the body back for his father." And now he realizes the price he pays for chumming up with Aeneas. As he spoke, he pressed, so this is Turnus, as he spoke, he pressed with his left foot upon the dead and pulled away the massive weight of sword belt. So Turnus now is taking the sword belt of Pallas, but he's going to let the body be sent back. Graven with pictured crime, that company, Aegyptus' son killed by Danaus' daughter, young men murdered on one wedding night, their nuptial beds bloodstained, Eurytus' son Clonus had chased the images in gold. So that's what's carved in gold. Now Turnus gloried in it in his winning. The minds of men are ignorant of fate and of their future lot, unskilled to keep due measure when some triumph sets them high. This is Virgil actually inserting himself into the text. If you took American Lit, it's very much how Harriet Beecher Stowe puts herself right into Uncle Tom's cabin and just talks to the audience. He's talking to us, giving that, us that piece of philosophy. The minds of men are ignorant of faith, fate, and of their future lot, unskilled to keep due measure when some triumph sets them high. For Turnus, there will come a time, line 705, so this is foreshadowing, there will come a time when he would give the world to see again an untouched palace, and will hate this day, hate that belt taken. Now on the battleground, Pallas's troops in tears with many groans, thronged to bear off the prince, laid on his shield. O grief, O glory, destined for your father, this your first day gave you to the war, and took you from it, even though you leave windrows of Rutulian dead. No rumor only of this great loss, but a sure messenger ran to Aeneas, telling how his men were now within an ace of being destroyed, how he must lose no time stemming the rout. Near enemies he cut down with his blade, then made a swath before him in the ranks, driving on Turnus where the man stood, proud of his new kill. Pallas, Evander, all their history rose before Aeneas's eyes. So Aeneas is going to fly into a rage, just like Achilles did after Hector killed Patroclus, because now Turnus has killed his friend, his new best friend, Pallas. Their history rose before Aeneas's eyes. The first feast he had come to as a stranger. The right hands joined in friendship. Now he took four sons of Sulmel, four more Ufens reared, took them alive to offer to the shades in sacrifice, wetting with captive blood the flames of Pallas's pyre. So Aeneas now is offering human sacrifice on for Pallas's funeral pyre, just like Achilles did. Magus, at whom he made a spear cast, cleverly dodged ahead, so all a quiver the shaft passed over him. Embracing then the spearman's knees, he pled, I pray you, by your father's ghost, and by your hope of Iulus's Julius, writhing power, preserve a life here for a father and a son. I have a great house. Hidden deep within are bars of encased silver, weights of gold, both finished and unfinished. Victory for Trojans cannot hinge on this one case. This one life cannot weigh so much. And, of course, this guy is begging for his life, just as someone begged Achilles for his life, and then Achilles killed him. Aeneas retorted in this way, those bars of gold and silver that you tell of, spare for your sons. Turnus has already done away with all such war trade, Pallas being lost. My father Anchises' ghost feels as I say, and so does Iulus, Ascanius Julius. And with this he took the man's helm in his left hand, bent the neck backward, still begging, and drove home the sword up to the hilt. Next, not far off, he met Hermeneides, a sacred minister of Phoebus, Apollo, and Diana, Artemis, of the crossroads, wearing the holy headband all in white, and shining priestly robes. Over the field Aeneas drove him till the man went down, then stood his mighty shadow covering him, and took his life in sacrifice. Serestus bent for his arms and shouldered them to be your trophy, Mars Gradivitus, battle king. The Italians rallied, led by Caeculus of Vulcan's line, and Umbro from the Marcian mountains, and the Dardans still raged on against them. With his blade he cut away Anchor's left arm with all his round of shield. This man had made some loud threat, thinking words would summon prowess, carried away perhaps, and sure long years would bring him hoary age. Hoary age with white hair. Then to confront Aeneas's fiery course, Tarchetus came, elate with flashing arms. Line 775. A son the nymph Diope bore to Faunus, god of woodland. Spear drawn back and thrust, Aeneas pinned his big shield to the cuirass, putting him out of action. As Tarchetus vainly pled and would have pled again, the Trojan struck his head off to the ground. Then with his foot made the warm trunk roll over, speaking from him above with his pitiless heart, lie there now, fearsome as you are. No gentle mother will ever hide you in the earth or wait your body with a family tomb. Either you stay here for the carrion birds or the sea takes you under. Hungry fishes nibble your wounds. So Aeneas is really getting mean and angry. Aeneas then ran onward after Atenas and Lucas. He's gone berserk. Front rank men of Turnus, Numa the brave and Tawny Carner, son of great-hearted Volscens, wealthiest landowner in Ausonia once, who ruled the silent town Amclae. As men say, the Titan Aegean had 100 arms, 100 hands, and sent out burning breath from 50 mouths and breasts when he opposed Jove's thunderbolt, clanging his 50 shields and drawing 50 swords. Just so Aeneas, so just like a guy in mythology that I don't remember, had 100 arms and fought off Jove's thunderbolt with 100 arms and all that. So Aeneas was just like Jove with 100 arms. Just so Aeneas multiplied savagery over the whole field, over once his sword point warmed. Now see him rushing Niphias's four-horse team, their breast against him when they catch sight of him, with his long strides and murderous moaning. They wheel round in fear, careering backward, spilling out their driver, whirling the chariot along the shore. At the same time, Lycagus and his brother Liger drove their white team into action, Liger at the reins, while grim Lycagus made play with his sword. Far from inclined to await their fiery onset, Aeneas rushed them, looming with his spear aimed. Liger called, "This is not Diomedes' team, you see, and not Achilles' war car, chariot, not the field of Phrygia. It's not Troy. Here and now on Latin ground, you'll have an end of war, an end of life." So in his madness he proclaimed. The Trojan warrior called out nothing in reply, but sent his javelin spinning, hanging on and bending to the stroke, using his blade to goad the team left foot overhead. Lycagus settled himself to fight, just as the spear broke through his gleaming shield's rim at the bottom, penetrating his left groin. Pitched from the car, he rolled out dying on the field. Aeneas, that grave captain, mocked him bitterly. "No panic of your team lost you your footing. No mere shadows of enemy ahead made them shy backward. No, you've tumbled out and left them of your own accord." With this, he took hold of the horse's heads. Lycagus' luckless brother slid from the chariot and held his hands out helplessly and said, "I beg you, in your own name, in the name of those who gave you life, great as you are, soldier of Troy, let this life be in mercy. Hear my prayer." So he prayed on, but Aeneas said, "Your speech was not like this just now. Die and be brotherly. Stay with your brother." He slashed open the breast where life is hid, and deaths like these all over the battlefield the Dardan captain brought about in fury, wild as a torment or dark tornado. Finally, Ascanius and the troops, besieged in vain, broke out and left the camp. Line 850. At this point, Jupiter slyly said to Juno, so now we go back up into Mount Olympus and the gods are talking. "A sister and wife, too, most delightful wife, as you were thinking, not amiss that thought, it must be Venus who sustains the Trojans, not their good right arms in war, their keen combativeness and fortitude in danger." In low tones, Juno answered, "A darling husband, why provoke me, heartsick as I am, and fearing as I do your grim decrees? If my love mattered to you as it did and should, you would not, O omnipotent, deny me this, the power to spirit Turnus out of the battle, and to keep him safe for his father Daunus. Well, then, let him perish. Give Trojans quittance with his gentle blood. And yet he took his name for our own stock, his sire Pilumnus, 4 generations gone. And generously he has often heaped your shrine with offerings." The king of High Olympus briefly answered so Zeus to Hera. "If a reprieve is asked from imminent death, more time for the young man before he falls, if you so understand me, take Turnus off in flight, wrest him away from fate that stands before him. There is room for that much lenience, so he can't stop Turnus from dying, but he can stall it for a while. If some greater favor lies hid in your mind beneath your prayer, if you imagine the whole war affected, changed by this, you cherish a vain hope." Then Juno said in tears, "Oh, if at heart you mean to grant what you begrudge in words, and life were still ahead, assured for Turnus, now heavy dooms ahead for him, the innocent, else I'm adrift from truth. Oh, let me be deluded, let my fear be baseless. Change your purpose for the better as you can." So do whatever you can. With this, from heaven straightway, she launched herself in a tucked-up robe of cloud, driving a storm before her through the air. She made her way to the Ilian lines and the Laurentine camp, then made a bodiless shade of spectral mist in likeness of Aeneas. So Junus makes a look-alike Aeneas out of clouds. This is to trick Turnus into following it to safety, so that Turnus can't run away and be brave, but he could think he was chasing this likeness of Aeneas and then be safe, and that's Juno's purpose. In likeness of Aeneas, weird and strange, adorned the image with Dardanian arms and matched the godlike hero's shield and plume, gave unreal words, a voice without a mind, a way of walking modeled after his. Line 900. This form was like the ghosts that after death are said to hover and haunt, or shapes of dream deluding sight and sleep in touch. Now then, before the front line, sprang the happy phantom, angering Turnus with a threat of arms and shouted challenges. Turnus attacked at the extreme range, hurling a whizzing spear. The phantom wheeled, turning its back, and ran. At this, thinking in truth his enemy had given ground, Turnus, in his confusion, drank deep of an empty hope. He called, "Where bound, Aeneas. Come, don't leave behind your wedding vows. That earth you sailed to find, you'll get from my sword arm. And shouting this, he pressed on after, making his drawn sword flash, not seeing that his jubilation now was at the mercy of the wind. One ship, it happened, stood there moored to a high rock ledge, ladders and gangway out. King Asinius had sailed it from the Clusium. The distraught phantom of Aeneas, in flight, ran here to fling itself overboard and under cover. Hard on its heels, past every obstacle, Turnus bounded over the steep gangway. He had scarce reached the prow when Juno broke the mooring line and wrenched the ship away, adrift on the ebb of surf. Ashore, Aeneas called for the absent man to stand and fight, while he sent down to earth many a soldier met on the field. But now the weightless phantom looked for a lair no longer. Soaring up, it mingled with a black cloud, as high wind bore Turnus out to sea. And he gazed back, bewildered at this business, giving no thanks for safety. Then he spread his hands to heaven and cried out. So Turnus is really upset that now he's all safely at sea. Father Almighty, have you found me to be so deplored and so chastised? Why am I sea-born? And from where and why this flight? Or what am I to be so taken? Shall I see my encampment or Laurentium's walls again? What of that company of men who rode with me, followed my flag? Monstrous that I have left them all to face a death unspeakable. Now must I see them leaderless and hear the wounded groaning? What shall I do? What chasm on earth is deep enough to hide me? Better winds, be merciful, drive this ship on a rocky coast. A reef, with all my heart I beg you, put her aground in savage sandbanks where no Rutulians or news of my disgrace can come. In other words, he would never actually run away from this is all the gods have done this. He prayed, and in his spirit swayed this way and that, whether for madness at so great a shame to fit his breast upon the blade and drive it through his rib, commit suicide, or else to plunge amid the waves and swim for shore, that curving shore where he could meet again the two Creans in arms. Three times he moved to try each way. Three times almighty Juno held him back, pitying him in her heart, and curbed the young man's passion. Smoothly onward, cutting a wake in the deep sea, he sailed, with favoring swell and current, carried home to the ancient city of his father, Daunus. Meanwhile, hot-headed Mezentius joined the fight, being by Jove alerted, and he drove against the cheering Trojans. But the Etruscan lines converged on him with all their hatred. Line 971. On him alone with all their javelins, cast in a continual shower. He weathered it the way a rocky headland jutting into the waste sea, bare to the sea surge, taking all the blows and fury of the sky and sea, remains unshaken, buffeting back. So this guy's like a big rock that can just stand there with have all this thrown at him. So he brought Hebrus down, Dialochon's son, then Lategus and Palmus on the run, one smashed in mouth and face by a huge stone, a bit of mountain crag, the other hamstrung, left to his slow writhing. Even while Mezentius handed Lausus shoulder armor and a plume to wear upon his crest, he killed Evanthes then, the Phrygian, and Mimas, peer and friend of Paris. Theano bore him to Amycus on the same night that Cisseus's royal daughter Hecuba, pregnant with a firebrand, bore Paris. Paris lies in Priam's town. Line 990. The Italian beach holds Mimas the Forgotten. Think of a wild boar, one Mount Vesulus, kept safe on his pine forest many years before the nipping hounds harried him out. Or one the Laurentine marsh for long has fed on reedy undergrowth. Now ringed by hunters, ready with nets, he stands at bay and snorts ferocious with his bristling hump and lets no one's blood is enough to go in closer. They keep safely away as they attack with darts and shouts while he turns on them all, undaunted, waiting for the time to charge, gnashing his tusks and shrugging off the darts. So men who justly hated Mezentius had not the gall to meet him, blade to blade, but harried him with darts and wild shouts at a safe distance. There was a man, Acron, come from Corythus' old country, a Greek exile, who left his marriage unfulfilled. Line 1010. As he drove Rutulians into disarray, in crimson plumes, in rose red of his bride, Mezentius caught sight of him apart. As, what was it like when he caught sight of him apart? As an unfed lion prowling in the bush and ravenous catches sight of a wild goat or a tall antlered stag, then he exults and gaping terribly ruffles up his mane before he kills and cleaves to a feast of flesh while blood bathes and befouls his cruel jaws. With such a spring, Mezentius fell upon the dense-ranked enemy. Unlucky Acron crumpled first and kicked the black earth, dying, splashing with blood, the spear shaft broken off. But when Orodes turned to run, the killer scorned to hit him from behind, to cast unseen and wound him. No, he caught and turned him, facing man to man, proving the better by force of arms, not by an unfair shot. With foot pressed rest on the dying where he lay. He pulled his spear out, calling, "Here's no mean partaker in this battle, men. Here lies Herodes, once so high." The Italian troops shouted together, echoing in ovation. Then, however, as he expired, Herodes whispered, "Whoever you are, you'll not take joy in this death long, for it will be avenged. An equal destiny awaits you here. The same field will be yours to lie in soon." "Die." Mezentius answered, smiling in hard anger, "Die now, but as for my fate, let the Father of Gods and King of Men attend to it." He pulled the spearhead from Herodes' body. Harsh reproach oppressed his eyes, a sleep of iron, and in eternal night they closed. Now Caedicus cut Alcaeus down. Cerater killed Hesphides, Rapo killed Parthenius, and Orses, man of brawn, Mesanthius finished Clonius and Erechtheus, Lycaon's son, one fallen from his unbridled mountain, lying prone, the other on foot. On foot the Lycaon, Aegis, too, came forward, only to be hurled in the dust by one who had his grandfather's bravery, Phalerus. Next Thronius fell to Salius. Salius fell before Neocles, dead shot with a javelin and the sly arrow striking at a long range. In the battle now, Mars evenly dealt out to both sides, heavy grief and mutual death, both killing, both going down in equal numbers, winners and losers neither any longer knowing the meaning of retreat. The gods, in Jove's long hall, pitied the empty rage of these two armies and the painful toil mankind must bear. From here Venus looked on, there her opponent Juno, while death pale, Tisiphone, and savagery roamed the field amid the soldiers in their thousands. Yes, and Mezentius shook a giant spear as he stormed over the field, tall as Orion when he wades through expanses of the sea, with shoulders unsubmerged, or when he brings an ash, or when he brings as aged ash-tree staff from the mountain heights and treads on earth, hidden, head hidden in the clouds. So giant Mezentius came on in his enormous armor. Sighting him in the long battle line, Aeneas made his way toward him. Mezentius stood fast, utterly fearless, bidding his gallant foe, immobile, massive, measuring with his eye the distance needed for his throw, and said, "My right arm, only God I have, and shaft I now let fly beyond my side. I pledge you, Lausus, armed in what I stripped from him, from this freebooter's body, you shall be my trophy of Aeneas." After his speech he made a long cast, and the whistling spear winged on, clanged on the shield, but sprang away to fix itself between the flank and groin of Antares, a distinguished soldier there, Heracles' old companion. Sent from Argos, he stayed close to Evander, and made his home in an Italian town. Killed by a stroke that missed another, now he lay and skyward turned his eyes in death, and remembering the sweet land, Argos. Then the god-fearing captain Aeneas made his throw, through the round shield, convex with triple bronze, layers of linen worked with triple bull's hide. The spear passed and struck low in the groin, line 1105. Yet at the end it lost its force. Cheering at seeing Etruscan blood, Aeneas in a flash drew sword from hip and closed in with his shocked enemy. Now Lysias, and this is where Aeneas is going to kill King Mezentius, who is a prince, a son of Mezentius. Now Lausus groaned at the sight for love of his dear father, and down his cheeks the tears rolled. "Here indeed I shall not fail to tell of that hard death you came upon, and of your heroism, if ancientness for a great act wins belief, and of your memorable self, young soldier." Mezentius had begun to back away, disabled, hampered, dragging on his shield the enemy spear, when in a lightning move the young man threw himself into the fight. Just as Aeneas rose for a downward cut, he beat aside the blade, and for a space put the man off. Italian troops came up with shouts, while under cover of Lassus's shield the father limped away. The soldiers' javelins harassed Aeneas and kept him back, so he took shelter behind his shield in a black rage. What was it like, his anger? As when the storm clouds pour down hail in showers, every farmer and plowman leaves the field, and every traveler takes cover, snug in some good shelter, overhanging bank of rock vault, while the rain falls, they defer the day's work till the sun comes out again. So, swamped by missiles left and right, Aeneas suffered the war cloud till its thunder passed, and meanwhile, line 1135, had harsh words and threats for Lausus. "Why this rush deathward, daring beyond your power? Filial pity makes you lose your head." But Lausus, all the same, leapt to the clash beside himself. Now, in the Dardan captain, anger boiled up higher, Aeneas. The parquet, the fates, wound the threads of Lausus to the end. So the parquet, imagine they're winding the fabric of his life to the very end. Aeneas drove his tough sword through the young man's body, up to the hilt, for it pierced the half-shield, light defense for one so menacing, and the shirt his mother had woven him, soft cloth of gold, so blood filled up the folds of it. His life now left his body for the air and went in sorrow to the shades. But seeing the look on the young man's face in death, a face so pale as to be awesome, then Anchises' son, Aeneas, groaned in profound pity. He held out his hand, as filial pity, mirrored here, wrung his own heart, and said, "Oh, poor young soldier, how will Aeneas reward your splendid fight? How honor you in keeping with your nature? Keep the arms you loved to use, for I return you to your forebears, ashes and shades, if this concerns you now, unlucky boy. One consolation for sad death is this, you die by the sword thrust of great Aeneas." Then, giving Lausus's troops a sharp rebuke for hanging back, he lifted from the ground the dead man as he lay, his well-combed hair soaking with blood. By rippling Tiber now, his father slowed the bleeding of his wound with river water and eased himself, his back against a tree trunk. His bronze helm nearby hung from the boughs, and on the grass in peace his heavy armor lay. Men of his choosing stood in a circle, he himself in pain, his flowing beard combed forward on his chest, panted and tried to rest to ease his neck. Repeatedly he asked for news of Lausus, repeatedly sent messengers to recall him, bearing his father's gloomy father's word. But weeping troops bore Lausus, lifeless on his armor, a mighty prince brought down by a mighty wound. Mezentius's heart knew well for whom they wept when still far off. Gouging up dust, he soiled his white hair, spread his arms to heaven, and when the body came, he clung to it. So the father's wounded, laying against a tree, and now they bring the body of his son. The king and the prince. "Did such pleasure in being alive enthrall me, son, that I allowed you, whom I sired, to take my place before the enemy's sword? Am I, your father, saved by your wounds? By your death do I live? Aye, now at the end exile is misery to me. Now the wound of it goes deep. There's more, my son. I strained your name with wickedness, driven out as I was under a cloud from throne and scepter of my ancestors. Long since I owed my land, my hating folk punishment for my sins. I should have given my guilty life up, suffering every death. I live still, nor yet have I taken leave of men in daylight, but I will." At this he stood up on his anguished thigh, and though strength ebbing and the deep wound made him slow, undaunted he commanded that they bring his mount, his pride and stay on which he rode from all his wars victorious. Then he said to the mournful animal, "Rabus, we too have had a long life now, if lives are ever long for mortals. Either you win today and bring that armor yonder back, blood-smeared Aeneas's head too, and avenge with me what Laius had to bear, or, if no force can clear that way, you'll die as I must die. Braveheart, I know you will not bend the neck to strangers' orders or to Trojan masters." So he's talking, saying goodbye to his horse. He eased himself on the warm back of the horse, astride him as before, and took a sheaf of javelins in each hand, his bronze helm shining. Horsehair plume a bristle, and off he galloped into the battle lines. In that one heart, shame seethed amain, and madness mixed with grief. 3 times with a great voice he called Aeneas, who knew the voice and prayed in joy. "So be it, so may the Father of Gods and high Apollo bring it on. Begin the fight!" At this he moved on up to meet him with his spear. Mezentius in his turn said, "Hard enemy, how can you think to terrify me now? My son is lost. That was the only way you could destroy me. Neither do I quail at death nor act in deference to any god. So drop your talk. I come resolved to die. But first there are these gifts I bring to you." At once he hurled a javelin at his enemy, then sent another, and another still, straight to the mark, as he rode wide around in a great circle. But the golden boss held intact, his shield held. Leftward the assailant rode three times around. Aeneas faced the shots, and 3 times turned a thicket of javelins on the bronze shield. The contest long drawn out, the toil of plucking steel points from his shield. The disadvantages of fighting on foot grew wearisome. Racking his brains, at last he burst from his position to hurl a spear squarely between the temples of the war horse. The beast reared back and high, pawing the air with its forefeet. Then on his rider thrown, the horse came down, entangling the man, and with his shoulder out of joint, headlong he plunged and pinned him. Trojan and Latin shouts flared from heaven. Aeneas on the run came up, pulling his sword out of the sheath, stood over him and said, Where's the fierce Mezentius now and his bloodthirsty soul? The Etruscan, with his eyes cast up, regained his senses, drinking in the air of heaven, answering, Bitter as gall, my enemy, what pillory me, and why pillory me, and hold up death before me? Taking my life, you do no wrong. I had no other expectation coming to battle. Lossus, my son, made no compact with you, that you should spare me. One request I'll make, if conquered enemies may ask a favor, let my body be hid in earth. I know on every hand the hatred of my people. Fend off their fury, and allow me room in the same grave with my son. This said, he faced with open eyes the sword's edge at his throat, and poured his life out on his armored breast in waves of blood.